Hello and welcome to Name Drop San Diego. I'm Christy Totten.
And I'm Abby Hamblin. On this podcast, we interview interesting San Diegans, and on this episode, we have an author who's getting a lot of national attention for her latest book.
Locals may know Jean Guerrero from her reporting for KPBS. Her first book, Crux, a cross-border memoir, looked into her own family story in both the United States and Mexico.
Now, she's looking into a very influential individual who hails from Southern California, but wields his power in Washington, D.C. Her latest book is called Hate Monger: Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda.
Stephen Miller is a senior advisor in the White House. Jean talked to us about why she chose to write about him, what she learned about him in the process, and how she's grown as a writer.
Here's our conversation with Jean Guerrero. So we wanted to start by kind of localizing, you've been seen all over national news and such lately for your new book, but you grew up right here in San Diego, right? But it was kind of a cross-border experience. Can you explain a little bit about how you grew up or where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up in Chula Vista and going across the border often. My dad's an immigrant from Mexico, and we would often go to Tijuana and Rosarito, to go down to shop at the markets, to go fishing and things like that. I didn't really have a real concept of the border other than, like, occasionally there were these very long waits that we would have to sit through coming back into the United States. But yeah, just often, like, from a very young age, going back and forth across the border.
How did you get interested in writing and journalism?
So I just, from a very young age, loved reading books. I remember, like, trying to learn the English language, because Spanish was my first language, and I just remember how fun it was to look at English language children's books and try to learn English through them. And I just loved the smell of the children's books and just loved, like, the act of immersing myself in letters and sentences. And so I think I've always sort of wanted to be a writer. I don't think I had a concept of that I would eventually become a journalist until later on in high school. But from a very young age, I wanted to write books. And then in high school, I had a high school English teacher who really encouraged me to get into journalism. And it felt like a kind of a perfect, because ultimately I wanted to write books, but the idea of just sitting in my room and making stuff up was not as exciting as the idea of going out into the world and, you know, talking to people I wouldn't normally talk to and go places I wouldn't normally go, and then using that material to write longer pieces.
What are some of the first stories you did as a student journalist?
Actually, I remember the first piece that I ever freelanced. I had done some stuff in high school, but my very first piece that actually was printed, and it was for the San Diego City Beat, and it was a assignment that I did for my journalism school in college, looking at the cross-border environmental issue here, looking at the Tijuana River Valley and the pollution that was crossing the border. And I just remember just, like, how cool the experience of reporting that was, because I would go back and forth with my dad, go into Los Laureles Canyon in Tijuana to look at, you know, these canyons where a lot of the sewage comes through because of the lack of infrastructure, and just realizing how closely entwined our countries are on so many levels. And I think that's when I started to realize that I wanted to be a reporter covering Mexico and Latin America issues, was during that process.
So yeah, your bylines and your book covers and some of the introductions of you often say that you reported in Mexico probably prior to KPBS. What was that sort of background?
Yeah, I mean, my first job was as a correspondent in Mexico City for the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires. I'd gotten an internship at the Wall Street Journal in LA, and I really wanted to stay with the company. And I saw that they had this opening for a commodities correspondent in Mexico City, and I applied and I got it. And it was a dream come true, because my dad was born in Mexico City. And I always had this idea that I wanted to write a book about my dad. I mean, my dad, he struggled with substance abuse and, what my mother always told me was paranoid schizophrenia throughout my life. And I just wanted to explore the concept of borders on like this very metaphysical level that my father represented, crossing borders between not only countries, but between, you know, reality and imagination and things like that. And so I decided to go to Mexico City, not only to become a correspondent and cover the rural sector in Mexico and Central America, but also to learn more about my dad's roots. And ultimately, that's what kind of what led me to write my first book, Crux, combining my experience as a reporter down there and also learning a lot about my family history.
Yeah, what was that like diving into your own personal story? It sounds like it would be tough.
Yeah, I mean, it was because it was this whole like I had followed my father down this rabbit hole for so many years, becoming obsessed with his story and with his beliefs and, you know, filing Freedom of Information Act requests with the FBI and the CIA and trying to actually entertain the possibility that some of what my father was telling me was true. I mean, this idea that the CIA was experimenting on him, because as a journalist and as his daughter, I felt compelled to like, even if it was like the remotest possibility that it was true, I felt the need to investigate. And, but it led me down this very self-destructive path where I started to sort of lose touch with reality myself. And I ended up using journalism and the tools that I had learned as a reporter to kind of bring myself back to reality. So the writing of the book ended up being a lot different than what I expected. It was like me trying to actually disentangle myself for once from my father and trying to find my own way apart from him.
That's really interesting. I feel like journalism does demand so much of our mental health and just sort of our constant evaluating of things that are going around us and how they affect us personally, but also be removed from them. What did you learn as far as being a reporter about that process and how to, like, I don't know, stay healthy and sane through so much of this kind of questionable material?
Well, it's just like when I was in college, I was very prone to conspiracy theories. And I was very much like my dad in a way. It's just so exciting to think that you've discovered this secret story and this a simple solution to all of the things that are going wrong in the world or in your life. And I feel like if I hadn't become a journalist and if I hadn't learned these tools and used them to disentangle myself from my father, I could have very easily ended up in a place like, you know, so many of the conspiracy theorists that we are seeing in our society today, just multiplying because of the fact that, you know, we live in a digital world where we are constantly bombarded with false information. And it's just so easy to get wrapped up in these conspiracy theories. But with journalism, like, I just, you know, you learn, you have to check the source, you have to try wherever possible to find primary documents. You can't just believe something because it resonates with some pre-existing notion that you have of the way that the world works. And that nuance and complexity was a real gift that journalism gave me, and one of the reasons that I just believe that journalism is so integral to our democracy.
I feel like this should be your next book subject. There's a lot of conspiracy going around right now.
I know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is I wish most people had the same perspective.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's just so easy to... It's a lot of money is being made from disinformation and from, you know, peddling conspiracy theories. And it's just awful how people are being preyed on, especially during this time of crisis where, like, people want, you know, they want some kind of reassurance in the form of an answer for why, you know, we're living in this time of crisis, and that is being preyed on. And, you know, you see the Trump administration deliberately shaking faith in journalistic institutions, and it's just making it so much harder for people to distinguish between fact and fiction.
Do you feel like your background and your sort of inherent interest in conspiracy theories gives you a leg up as a journalist to sort of combat this information and understand where people are coming from and appeal directly to them and possibly change minds?
I think so. I mean, for me, it helps me to understand Stephen Miller, actually, because, you know, Stephen Miller, Trump's senior advisor and speechwriter, he was radicalized at a very young age because he was, you know, being exposed to these narratives that brown and black people pose some kind of existential threat to civilization. And he was exposed to them during a very vulnerable period in his life, having, you know, a lot of family turmoil. And it gave him a sense of mission and a sense of purpose that conspiracy theories often fill that void in us. And so for me, it helped me to understand, you know, the psychology of Stephen Miller and how he ended up, you know, essentially a case study in indoctrination and you know, became what he is today, which is an extremist who is the most powerful advisor in the White House.
Yeah, your second book, Hate Monger, came out this year. It's about Stephen Miller. How did you set your sights on him?
So I had been covering the family separation crisis here at the border, and I kept hearing the White House talk about how this family separation policy was about law and order, and about, you know, they were only going after people who broke the law, and this was about national security. But I was on the ground. This is, you know, as you know, the busiest border crossing in the United States, and I was interviewing all of these parents who had been separated systematically from their children after having broken no laws whatsoever, you know, having presented at ports of entry. One father in particular from El Salvador who had a one-year-old baby, had no criminal record, presented legally at a port of entry, said he feared persecution, passed his credible fear interview, and was separated for 8 months from his baby. And so for me, that raised the question, like, well, what are these policies really about? I mean, clearly they're not about just law and order, as the White House is saying. And to answer that question, I felt like I had to look at Stephen Miller, the man who was designing these policies, and, you know, understand what was motivating him.
It kind of seems like for your first book, you were always sort of pulling string and thread together that ultimately, and you've always wanted to write books. But what is that process like, you know, shifting from sort of daily reporting or stories that come out in a news outlet to investigating long term this person and then turning it into a book?
Well, this book, Hate Monger, was such a completely different reporting and writing experience from my first book, Crux, because Crux was such a personal endeavor, and it took years, and it was something that I'd been thinking about pretty much since high school. And, you know, just had a lot of time to think about it and have it evolve. Whereas Hate Monger, I got the book deal in May of last year and had to turn in the manuscript by November. So it was a 6-month timeline. And, you know, just entailed completely immersing myself in Stephen Miller's life for the first couple of months, you know, from the moment I would wake up till the moment I fall asleep, maybe with some breaks for eating in there, I would just, you know, first of all, read everything that I knew that I learned inspired Stephen Miller to try to really get inside his head. And then, you know, interviewing everyone, more than 100 people who knew him, classmates, family members, colleagues, other officials in the White House, to try to understand him. And it was, I always tend to write longer than I'm supposed to in reporting. Like when I write a script or a story, writing a lot is not a difficulty for me. It's just about, you know, for me, it's like one of the funnest things is to pull together a bunch of information into a coherent narrative. And one of the ways I did that was that from day one of my reporting, I was creating a timeline that would serve as the skeleton for the book, and just constantly adding to that timeline. And I knew I was going to have to write the book chronologically because of the short time frame. I wasn't going to have time to experiment with the structure or move back and forth in time the way I do with Crux. But that was like a major tool and that helped me organize everything.
I can picture this kind of like, it seems like you would need one of those like walls full of like the maps and the faces and the lines going from one to another. Is it hard to like take so much information? But on the other hand, it seems like in some senses you didn't have access to information. Like what, how did you balance sort of not being able to talk to Stephen Miller, but also, you know, getting a lot about him?
Yeah. I mean, I tried to speak to Stephen Miller. I reached out to him the moment that I got the book contract and reached out to the White House. And at first they, you know, said that they were thinking about it, and but ultimately they just decided not to participate. And I think it goes to, you know, Stephen Miller, one of the ways that he's lasted so long in the White House is that he's always careful to cast himself as a mere devoted vehicle for Donald Trump. He's very comfortable in his shadow, so he never, you know, makes Trump insecure the way that Steve Bannon did when he got his face on the cover of Time magazine as the quote-unquote great manipulator. So I think that's one of the reasons he decided not to participate in a book about him. But yeah, I mean, like what you're saying about like having the papers all around, I mean, I like to lay everything out on my floor. It's just so much easier than, I mean, when you're looking at the same material again and again on a computer, you stop seeing it after a while and you have to like find new ways to see it. So I'll put it on my floor. I did have, you know, this map of themes that I knew I needed to hit on my wall. Or rather questions that I needed to answer, like who is Stephen Miller? What has his impact been on real people's lives and things like that? Just making sure that those through lines were apparent throughout the narrative of the book. But yeah, I mean, like it's always one of the things that was super helpful for me was asking people for suggestions of other people to talk to, or also to see if they could share correspondence with me. And I was very surprised with what that led to, because Stephen Miller's mentors ended up sharing their emails that they exchanged with Stephen Miller. And I really didn't expect them to, but I asked anyway, and it was, you know, an incredibly rich source of material to pull from to understand, you know, how Stephen Miller was radicalized by these older conservatives at a very young age. I didn't want this book to be, you know, Stephen Miller has been so vilified in the press for so long, and I didn't want it to just, you know, I didn't want to paint Stephen Miller as this like completely, as this aberration. A lot of people talk about him like he's this bad guy that like nobody can possibly understand how anyone could be so cruel. But for me, it's very obvious that Stephen Miller and the entire Trump administration is the logical outcome of, you know, a decades long bipartisan assault on immigrants and you know, people of color. And Stephen Miller is a product of that.
How did you get his family to talk to you?
So David Glosser, his uncle, had written, his maternal uncle had written an article in Politico about how his nephew Stephen Miller is an immigration hypocrite because they're, you know, they're descendants of Jewish refugees who came to this country fleeing persecution in Eastern Europe, came to this country without speaking any English, with no money, and, you know, nothing but the clothes on their backs. And if the policies that Stephen Miller is putting in place today had been in place back then Stephen Miller would probably not be alive today. And so David Glosser was sort of my in to the family. He put me in touch with a number of other relatives who were open to talking about Stephen Miller. Most of them were tremendously, you know, felt a real sense of shame being associated with Stephen Miller's legacy, because the entire family had for so many years, you know, they donated to pro-immigration organizations. Stephen Miller's maternal grandmother spent her entire retirement compiling the family history for her grandchildren so that they would never forget the value of people who come to this country with nothing but the clothes on their backs. Wow. And she really stood for the importance of remembering. And this is something that, you know, Stephen Miller completely, you know, assaulted throughout his life, this idea that he completely disregarded. I am told, and I've seen some correspondence that suggests that Stephen Miller's parents are very much on board with him and what he's doing, and they declined to speak to me. as did his siblings, but a majority of Stephen Miller's family is just shocked at what he's been able to accomplish in the White House.
If you could talk to him or maybe even his parents or siblings, what do you want to know that you don't know now?
One of the first questions that I would ask him, and I've been mulling this for a while, is I would ask him what he thinks about this document that Ruth Glosser, his maternal grandmother, you know, compiled for him with these lessons that he's just completely ignored. I've always wanted to know what Stephen Miller's relationship with Ruth has been, you know, and unfortunately Ruth passed away just a few weeks ago from complications from the coronavirus. And I've wondered, you know, I've wanted to ask Stephen Miller, I mean, what do you think about these lessons that she recorded for you? And did you speak to her as she was on her deathbed? It's an amazing story, the contrast between Stephen Miller and his family members who you know, talked about the dangers of demonization that Stephen Miller, one of the first things he did in the White House was create an office that was dedicated to the daily demonization of immigrants, you know, pumping out press releases about alleged migrant crimes, including pictures of migrants' gang tattoos and things like that. And just asking him, I mean, do you think that, you know, what the lessons that Ruth tried to record for you were valid, or what is your interpretation of them? That's what I would like to know.
What is the response to Hatemonger been?
It's been really positive so far. I've actually been surprised with how civil things have been on Twitter. I'm not so much on Facebook, which was, I mean, I would have thought it would have been the other way around. I have gotten some threats of violence on my Facebook posts, but that's to be expected. And you know, ahead of the publication, I did work with PEN America to make sure that my cybersecurity was fully locked down, to make sure that, you know, I paid for this service that wipes the personal information, like addresses and phone numbers of myself and all of my family members from the people search engines online, so that I can't get doxxed and so that my family members can't get doxxed. Because, you know, my first book was so personal, their names are in there. I just don't want people targeting them because they disagree with my second book. And these are things that, you know, journalists haven't had to do before, but which are becoming a very common thing. If you write a political book, you need to take unprecedented steps to protect your safety and the safety of your loved ones.
You said it's to be expected, and I totally get that, but at the same time, I've never dealt with it. How do you deal with that, you know, seeing those comments?
I mentally prepared for it ahead of time, like just trying to, several weeks ahead of publication, like just, I couldn't take time off because like preparing for promotion was a full-time job, but I, you know, made sure that I was going to the beach, going paddleboarding, going surfing every now and then, and just trying to get into a space of in my mind where I could tell myself, well, you know, if there is a lot of negative reaction, it's because the book is powerful. It's because it's doing its job of, you know, destabilizing the narratives that are coming out of the White House. And so I just, every time that I see something, you know, really horrifically aggressive or violent, I just think to myself, it just means that it's working.
I don't know if you have thought this far ahead yet, maybe it's too soon to ask, but could you see yourself doing more of this sort of political writing, or, you know, more sort of long profile type books, or do you have plans for your next book?
Yeah, I don't think I want to write another very serious book for a while. I mean, right now I'm kind of like looking at writing a children's book with my sister because I just need a break mentally from this stuff. But I mean, I don't see myself ever getting away from investigative journalism around this issue. I mean, immigration and politics, especially just given how much I've learned through the Stephen Miller book. And one of the next things that I want to look at, because Stephen Miller, one of the ways he's been so powerful is he's developed these alliances with right-wing media provocateurs like Tucker Carlson, like Rush Limbaugh, like Ann Coulter. And these media personalities have played an enormous role in the era of polarization that we are living today. And a lot of these guys, you know, Tucker Carlson, he grew up in La Jolla. And so it's just, and you know, One America News Network, which has been so critical for Trump, is also in San Diego. There's just so many stories in San Diego that I definitely want to be looking at.
I would definitely read that book on Tucker Carlson, especially every time he kind of mentions California negatively, I always think like, are you ever going to talk about how you're from here or how you're from La Jolla? And now that there's sort of like talk about a presidential run, I mean, maybe you are right on time to write that. I would read that.
Yeah. I haven't seen any deep dives into his history and his childhood. And it just feels like something I would be fascinated to learn more about Tucker.
Also, Peter Navarro. I always like looking at what he's doing because I don't think a lot of people know he's a San Diego guy too.
Yeah. Well, a lot. Yeah. It's just amazing how much of the Trump administration has roots in Southern California and conservative thought that really grew here throughout the 90s.
So you mentioned in your interview on Fresh Air that you sort of felt connected to Stephen Miller a little bit because you did grow up in Southern California around the same time he did. What sort of stands out to who you are as a person and how Southern California sort of made you who you are versus what it made him?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel a sense of empathy for the young Stephen Miller who internalized a lot of the white supremacist rhetoric that was so common in California at the time. Because I remember even as the daughter of a Mexican immigrant, the daughter of a Puerto Rican mother, just really internalizing this. I mean, my dad used to wash my hair with chamomile shampoo because he wanted to keep it blonde because there was so much shame associated with being Mexican that had been created by the rhetoric. I remember my mom used to say, like, you are American, you are not Puerto Rican, you're not Mexican, you're American. And this was, you know, she wanted me to feel a sense of belonging that she hadn't felt because of her Puerto Rican accent. She had not been seen as belonging and she wanted me to have that. And, you know, so for me, it's like I understand Stephen Miller's desire to be perceived as American with all of the privileges that that is supposed to guarantee, you know, as someone who he also, you know, is a descendant of people who came to this country, you know, in completely different financial circumstances than what he was raised in. So that allowed me to approach Stephen Miller from, like, you know, an empathetic point of view. The difference is he continues to sound the same today as he did when he was 16. And for me, that's, you know, why I see him as a case study in indoctrination. He found this sense of purpose in you know, an older man coming to him, David Horowitz, telling him that he needed to save the United States from certain destruction in the form of the Democratic Party partnering with Muslims and Mexicans and other people of color. And, you know, this consumed his life. It ended up displacing his identity. His friends tell me that, you know, as a kid, he was kind of lighthearted and, you know, some people thought he was joking sometimes. And over time, you know, he lost that sense of lightness that used to be a part of his being. And he just became utterly consumed by this mission. And I think for me, I kind of moved in the opposite direction where I began to realize how self-destructive it was and how unhealthy it was to renounce and reject, you know, my own story and the story of my ancestors and the people who made me who I am today and gave me the privileges that I have today, and realizing that it's not incompatible to be American and also, you know, embrace these other sides of myself.
We're working on a different podcast called Hello Gen Z about how Gen Z is the most racially and ethnically diverse American generation ever. And that's kind of one of the central questions, is like how that will change America going forward, you know, and how people feel about it. And so that feeling that you just described, you know, maybe earlier in life trying to really assimilate and like sort of maybe denounce, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your background, doing the reporting you've been doing, do you see that changing? Do you see people being more accepting of their, you know, heritage and whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of Gen Z, I look at my niece who's, you know, part African-American, part Mexican, part Puerto Rican, part, she's just everything. And she's, you know, she represents the future. And for me, like, what that means is that nationally, we are going to go through the same process that we went through in California, where, I mean, right now we're seeing the same growing pains that we saw in California when white, when non-Hispanic white people became a minority demographically for the first time in California in the 90s. So there was this idea that, like, the third world was taking over, that there was going to be some horrible, you know, end to civilization. But obviously that didn't happen. You know, California just became an increasingly diverse place that embraced the strengths represented by multiculturalism. And I think that as the United States becomes more and more diverse, we are going to see an end. I mean, not an end, but we're going to see a definite decrease in tribalism, because people, when they are more mixed, when you have more hyphenated identities, you have a greater capacity for identification with multiple ways of being, and you have a greater capacity of for empathy with other groups of people, because you yourself identify as multiple things. And so I think, you know, we're going to become an increasingly multicultural and mestizo nation. And this is ultimately going to spell, you know, white supremacy is going to be relegated to the fringes once more.
I'm glad to hear that. Also, speaking of Gen Z, you have a new guide out for students who are interested in writing nonfiction. What advice do you have?
Yeah, so one of the most helpful things for me, which I include in the guide, is just not becoming too hyper specialized. I remember, like, I majored in print journalism in college, and print journalism, I don't think it's not even a major anymore, at least at the college that I went to, because, you know, you can't just be a print journalist anymore. And I remember for a while, I kind of rolled my eyes at the idea of, like, oh, I need to shoot photos and do video and all these other things as well. Like, I'm a print journalist. And I was a little bit elitist about it. But then when I started to actually learn these other forms of storytelling, it was actually incredible, because it made me a better writer overall. You know, it forces you, when you're writing scripts for radio or scripts for TV, you learn how to be a more concise an authentic storyteller. Your voice becomes more infused with your own real voice. And, you know, this just benefits your storytelling and reporting skills overall when you're able to do multiple forms of storytelling.
Did you go to college here in San Diego?
I went to USC, University of Southern California in LA. Okay.
What do you feel like from your early days of freelancing and that first City Beat article and to where you are now as someone who can do really strong long-term projects? You know, how have you grown as a journalist, and how have you sort of settled into this career?
That's a good question. I think I've learned... I remember when I first started out as a journalist, I thought that if I was speaking to someone who I disagreed with, that I needed to, you know, pretend like I was on their side or something, and that I had to, you know, manipulate the situation in some way. And I've learned over the years as a journalist that the more honest you are from the get-go and the more integrity that you have, the more that people trust you regardless of where they stand. And it's just, it ends up producing a far better product, because, you know, you're not manipulating anyone for information. And, you know, it's just when there's mutual respect, and then you end up with a better story. And that's one thing that I've learned. I've learned over the, I mean, when I interviewed David Horowitz, for example, the mentor of Stephen Miller, you know, I was open with him with the fact that, you know, I'd read a lot of his writings. I was not in agreement with a lot of what he wrote, but I was very curious to try to see things from his point of view, and that, you know, helped him to trust me and to share information with me.
I've heard a lot of journalists talking about that, how the goal now is not necessarily to be unbiased, but to reveal your biases and own them, right? And just kind of represent them. So it sounds like you agree with that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's this idea that we have to be completely objective as journalists. And I do think that journalistic neutrality is a huge important part of our trade, of our profession. But I mean, we also need to be honest about the fact that we all come at stories with our own inherent biases. And the more that we're honest about that, the more that we can, you know, guard against allowing those biases to define our work.
That's great advice. It sounds like we should definitely check out your guide and learn a little bit more from you on that.
Thank you.
So this podcast is called Name Drop San Diego, and we like to always end our interviews with asking, is there someone here in San Diego County who you feel like either deserves a bit more of a spotlight that you would love to name drop, or maybe someone who's just very meaningful to you, whether it be a mentor, family member, or maybe someone you don't know? Do you have someone that you would want to name drop?
Yes, I'm trying to think which one. I would say my Liz Huerta is a writer in San Diego who is just amazing. Her stories are some of the best stories I've ever read, and she has a book coming out in the next, I believe next year. But she's the one who, you know, helped me find a community of writers in San Diego after I moved back here. I mean, I was born and raised in San Diego, but I had spent 4 years living in Mexico, first in Mexico City, then in the Yucatan Peninsula. And I came back to San Diego and I didn't know anyone. And, you know, I met Liz Huerta and she introduced me to the entire storytelling community here. And she's just an amazing writer and an amazing human who does so much to, you know, shed light on really important stories. And I would recommend that people check out her work.
That was a great name drop. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For those who missed it, Jean was also a part of the San Diego Festival of Books this year. Check it out at sdfestivalofbooks.com to see what it's all about.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us. If you like what we're doing with Name Drop San Diego, please share this podcast with a friend. We'd also love to read your reviews on your favorite podcast app.
This podcast comes out every Tuesday, and we're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search Name Drop SD.
Thanks for listening. Bye.